From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Rick Pantaleo, broadcaster in VOA's English division and author of the popular Science World blog, which you can find at voanews.com. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Amy Webb, author, futurist, and founder of Future Today Institute. That's a leading future forecasting and strategy firm that researches technology for a global client base. Amy Webb is also a lecturer on the future of media at Columbia University in New York City. She's the author of several books, the most recent of which, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. She has also published many articles relating to future technologies and trends. Previously known as Web Media Group, Future Today Institute advises Fortune 500 and Global 1000 companies, government agencies, large nonprofits, universities, and startups. Amy holds many professional affiliations and collaborates with a number of institutions. For the past 15 years, she has been dedicated to helping inform and shape the future of journalism. Well, speaking of which, fake news online has been at the center of a furious debate over how it may have influenced voters in the recent presidential election. President Barack Obama has warned that we are, quote, in an age where there's so much active misinformation and it's packaged very well on social media sites, unquote. The criticism has buffeted web companies such as Google and Facebook, whose chief executive Mark Zuckerberg has promised to work on technology tools to slow the gusher of false digital information. Fake news garnered support from a sophisticated Russian propaganda campaign. The fact that the Russian government is also allegedly behind cyber attacks on mostly democratic officials and entities and leaked the damaging information to WikiLeaks with the goal of hurting Democrat Hillary Clinton and helping Republican Donald Trump gives us a lot to discuss with our special guest, Amy Webb. And Amy joins us by phone from her office at the Future Today Institute. Amy Webb, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. It's great being here again.
We loved having you last year, and we're going to make this a regular program, hopefully. And I'd like to welcome my colleague, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello there.
He's our very own in-house science and technology guru. Well, Amy Webb, first, let's start with this phenomenon of fake news. How worried are you that so many Americans fell victim to utterly false conspiracy theories, propaganda, and misinformation on social media sites like Facebook, especially during this last election? And of course, some say that these stories may have even given Mr. Trump an advantage in his campaign against Democrat Hillary Clinton.
You know, I'm very concerned, but I think it's important to note that the phenomenon of fake news is not new. Humans have been misinforming each other since our ancestors were in caves, you know, 6 million years ago. So the phenomenon of fake news is not new, but it's catalyzed by the technology that we have that makes it easy and free for anybody to share content. It's compounded by the fact that our distribution systems, like our social networks and our search engines, make money the more that we click, and by the fact that our attention spans are limited. And so the more scandalous and salacious a news story seems, the algorithms that target us understand the more likely we are to click on those stories. So this is a problem that has been with us for a long time. It's come to the forefront because of the election and because foreign governments and individuals have figured out how to manipulate algorithms to their own financial or geopolitical gain, and because a lot of people are upset about the outcome of the election. This is not an easy problem to fix. There is no line of code or easy switch that we can push to fix all of this overnight. It's complicated.
Amy, looking at fake news, it appears from what you're saying and from what Carol was saying a little earlier that this is an amalgam of different ideas from cultural to technology. Mark Zuckerberg, as Carol mentioned, is planning to screen fake news as much as possible. Is the technology there today to allow him to do that?
You know, Facebook, Twitter, Google, these are platforms that have been around now for more than a decade. And while it may feel as though they are very modern and fresh, in a lot of ways, they're not very sophisticated, and a lot of the technology is still pretty rudimentary. Twitter could easily ban bots and botnets. It could easily make it so that those accounts that are intentionally spreading misinformation or are generating misinformation on their own, right? It could easily ban those. Facebook can easily and has time and time again banned photos that it feels are inappropriate. So it could absolutely shut off the tap for fake news. The challenge is in defining which news sources are credible and which ones aren't. The problem here is that politically, we may have ideologies that are different, but there are certainly independent news sources that are doing reasonable work and representing facts in a reasonable way, colored by commentary that may go against the grain of what you think. That's what's so difficult about this. You know, it's also not in the financial interest of these organizations to shut the tap off. I mean, look at the traffic. We're all clicking on Facebook. We're all paying a lot more attention to all of these news sources, all of these distribution platforms, and the reason is for the content.
Well, for example, you just said the word distribution platforms, and I think people confused distribution platforms like Facebook or Twitter and so forth with a news source, and that's part of the problem. So just because something appears on Facebook doesn't mean it's necessarily credible. And then there's the political question that you also raised, which is, you know, one news source for one person is somebody else's pure propaganda. For example, RT, Russia Today, that's pure propaganda by the Russian government.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought that up. People don't realize it. Some of your listeners have probably shared RT content without even realizing what it was. So they're very, very good at putting together packages of, like, it was a story about a new scientific study about how cats were the valiant pets of the Vikings. You know, so we've got all these really, and there's like photos of cats with Viking gear on, and it looks like something that might have been on BuzzFeed, right? It seems like a credible news story. But also from that exact same publisher are stories of supposed whistleblowers from the United States, from the UK, from countries all over the world who are saying things that are very much in line with the Kremlin's official stance. RT has been around for a decade. It is very much, you know, an arm of the Russian government. It is not independent journalism. It masquerades very, very well as a traditional news source. And on these distribution platforms, there is no arbiter. There is no editor who is flagging content before you share it as something that may be propaganda, may be factually incorrect. You know, the onus is on us to make those distinctions, but we are not doing a very good job of that.
That's a very good point, Amy. Thank you for elaborating on RT, that it's an arm of the Russian government. For example, recently they published some stories about Russian involvement in Syria, showing happy people in Damascus. I mean, we know that the Russians have bombed innocent people and hospitals to smithereens. They have done barbarous things, but the Russian people are not seeing that. So they're very selective and they distort the truth. But like you said, they masquerade as a media because some things they say may have a grain of truth to it. Now, then you brought up another point, which is media literacy. You know, no digital platform, even old-fashioned print media and electronic media, unless there's an editor or fact-checker, we're on our own, and people have just abdicated their sense of intelligence or something. They tend not to be able to distinguish truth from fiction. And certainly on social media, because there's no fact-checkers and editors to distinguish one news source from another, people just tend to believe what they hear or what they read, which is unfortunate.
I don't know that it's that they necessarily believe as much as, I mean, a lot of this is psychological, so it feeds into our desire to tell people that news is breaking. That's part of our fundamental human nature. We have this desire to tell people things. You know, storytelling is what separates humans from the other living things on the planet. Storytelling is how we learn from each other. It's how we share information, and the more stories that we can share, the more that feeds into essentially what is our basic biology. So that is why we seem to have so many dead celebrities pop up on Twitter and on Facebook, and even within our like stories that are on the New York Times and the Guardian, you see advertisement. You see what look to be related stories, right? I saw one the other day about Alec Baldwin being dead. And of course he's not, but a lot of us don't stop to check. Instead, we retweet what we've seen. because we want to be part of that megaphone. And it really goes to a baser human instinct. So it's complicated because it's not like a lot of people are doing this intentionally. It's that we can't help ourselves. And technology has aided and abetted our desire to just spread information.
Even if it's not true. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Amy Webb. She's founder and CEO of Future Today Institute. That's a leading future forecasting and strategy firm that researches technology for a global client base. Her latest book is The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is Rick Pantaleo, host of PCUSA Science Edition and author of VOA's Science World blog. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Mark Ome. He's a loyal listener from Enugu State in southeastern Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, Amy Webb, when I just said the word email, of course, that triggered a question with respect to email use last year in the year that we're exiting 2016, the hacking of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, email of Hillary Clinton, the Democratic candidate's campaign manager's server. What do you make of these hacks, allegedly by the Russian, or rather those affiliated with the Russian government? And do you see this perhaps continuing, these attempts? And what can we do, those of us who use email on a regular basis, do to protect ourselves?
You know, I think one of the very real issues we will be confronting in the next year or more is that at the moment in the United States, we don't have a clear definition of what constitutes a digital act of war. At this moment in time, seem to have credible intelligence that a foreign government permeated the inboxes of candidates in order to influence the election. What we do not know is what our response to that is. And that, I think, is really a good analogy for one of the great challenges that we will face on this planet going forward. And that is that our technology and the tools that are available to foreign governments, but also to everyday people, have become far more sophisticated than our abilities to legislate, regulate, and create norms for that science and technology. And as a result of that, we're probably going to continue to see events that challenge our notion of security or that make us ask questions about how much influence the government should have in the day-to-day use of our technology. And that's not something that is just something that the United States will be facing going forward. Every government, every person who is connected to the internet going forward is going to have to start thinking about that. Now, in terms of the email itself, one of the trends that's in our 2017 report that we are looking at going forward is the phenomenon of what's called organizational doxing. This is a term that security expert Bruce Schneier has written quite a bit about, and we would encourage anybody who's interested in this to go to his blog to learn more. But essentially, doxing is when hackers attack a person and take all of their personal information and put it online for others to see. And that has happened over the past few years. We saw that after a dentist in the United States went on a big game hunt and killed a well-known lion named Cecil. You saw the Cecil the Lion hashtag trend in social media. And suddenly that person's, his entire life was turned upside down. All of his information was made public online. So that's what we call doxing. But the next wave of this is a foreign government or people engaged in espionage or just hackers who are angry at a company. They do that not just to one person, but to all employees. And so we saw an example of that, I guess this was now 2 years ago, with the big Sony hack, when all the troves of information were made available to the public. And it was quite an embarrassment for many of the people, the executives who work at Sony. So I think there are ways to prevent, to sort of acknowledge and prevent this going forward at a very basic level.
Such as, for example, right, can you give us an example? Passwords.
Right. So, I mean, you know, on a very, very basic level, change your passwords often, make them difficult to crack, which means they have to be very, very long. don't use the same password for different websites. You know, if you run an organization, your IT department should be vigilant and should be paying attention to this stuff, making sure that your systems are shored up. So part of this is just acknowledging that this is a trend going forward and then being in a position to do something about it. It does point to this bigger problem of here in the United States, and I know this is true of other countries, you know, we haven't really thought through the implications. What constitutes a digital act of war? How far does somebody need to push us before we will retaliate? And what is an acceptable form of retaliation? And that, you know, that's a conversation that every government needs to be having.
We talk about sanctions, which is not a digital retaliation or cyber attack, but with respect to Russia. But is there any way any of these hacks, whether it was on the DNC or Sony or John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, could any of these attacks have been prevented? Were they baited by some email that said, open this, and then they opened it? I mean, are there some basic things that we could do or to ensure that we are safe from, as long as we're vigilant and don't open attachments from unknown sources? I mean, to some extent, can we prevent a lot of these hacks, or are they so sophisticated that they can still penetrate?
What I can say is our government uses a lot of technology. A lot of that technology is outdated. For example, a lot of people in the State Department here in the U.S., you know, have two different phones. When I go to visit the State Department, I have to put my phone in a special lockbox, right, so that you can't, so information isn't moving around. If you have a government phone, you're not supposed to plug it into a charging station at a conference, for example, because you could potentially spread malware or whatever. So some of it is just having that 21st century digital common sense. But there are plenty of cases where, again, the way that information moves around, and this goes back to what we were talking about with fake news, this is sophisticated stuff. You know, it is a challenge. I know that DARPA here in the U.S. is trying to fund and figure out a way to automate hacking so that we can get ahead of hackers by creating protocols that hack faster than humans. So there are various levels of our government and certainly of other governments that are working on this. I would say that the key takeaway here is to be ever vigilant on your own and to try to develop a smarter sense of common sense for our modern era.
Amy, when we're talking about fake news, misinformation, and so forth, and the word hacking, of course, is being used a lot in the news. And, of course, damage is being done by the mere presence of a foreign entity getting into a computer system. But it's a two-step issue here. Not only are we concerned about hacking the data, but the distribution of that data, such as WikiLeaks.
So again, I think this is something that DARPA is trying to address. They have a new Cyber Grand Challenge project. It's about designing an entire computer system or systems of computers that are capable of beating hackers at their own game. But we also have existing systems like WikiLeaks, which is really less of a giant computer network and more about a structure that's been created to make it easier for people to leak and share information. There are two elements to look at. So we've got WikiLeaks on the one hand, but on the other hand, we have the Panama Papers. Journalists in Western governments would look at the Panama Papers, which was a massive coordinated leak and subsequent publication. The people who are quite upset about that aren't so upset about WikiLeaks, and you know, reverse of that is true. So again, it's just a good reminder that in the year 2017, everybody has something to gain, everybody has something to lose online, and the weapons of the future, you know, may look a lot more like computer code than the guns, you know, and tanks that we were used to thinking about in the past.
Amy, I'd like you to talk about your new book, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. So why is that?
Why is that? So, you know, every year at the Institute, we put together this report, and that tells you what to be paying attention to in the years ahead. But it doesn't tell you how to do that yourself. And my great concern is that technology is becoming more and more complicated. And we've been talking about tech. We haven't even talked about science, things like CRISPR and gene editing and biohacking and the like. These tools have become ever more sophisticated and sort of more difficult. And my great concern is that we don't have enough people dedicated to thinking about their implications going forward. My work as a futurist, I think, is beneficial for the companies and the organizations that we advise. But in reality, I'd like for everybody to have access to the tools that I do as a futurist and to do the work that I do. So the book is that. It is an explanation of what futurism is. It is an explanation of how to think like a futurist. It was written for everybody. So after you read this book, you will have access to the exact same tools that I do. And with some practice, you will be able to forecast the future just like I do every day.
Speaking of technology and science, as you just mentioned, advancements in the CRISPR gene editing.
So again, this is where having the tools of a futurist becomes useful because it gives you a framework to think through these things. So if you're thinking about the future of CRISPR, you know, jumping from where we are right now to hacking into the genome for some purpose is one avenue, but maybe a different avenue to pursue would be to think through the fact that we don't have a national bioethics policy. Other countries do. China has a very different attitude towards editing human embryos than we do. When you combine CRISPR with what we know to be true today about artificial intelligence, that tells us, you know, within our lifetimes might have the ability to create human life in a different way that we do right now, augmenting it such that we create superhumans capable of really improving life on this planet, or we create super weaponized humans, you know, or any other number of things. So again, this is why it's important to unpack the information that we have. And to do that, you have to start at the fringe. You can't sort of just read the newspaper and think that you've got a good handle on what's coming. You've got to go back much deeper and look at academic research, pre-publication research, look at what biohackers are trying to do and that sort of thing to get a handle on what really is coming next.
We were talking about gene editing, for example, and it was mentioned about this may be of concern to diverse companies such as UPS, which is a delivery service, and Kroger, a national grocery chain. They should be looking into things that perhaps most people would think they have no involvement in, such as the gene editing.
That's right. So when we talk about gene editing, it's a big topic with a lot of complicating factors. But, you know, oftentimes we think about editing humans. There's a whole component of this that is agricultural. And one of the great promises of this technology is solving for very real food shortages all around the world. If through gene editing, which is not the same thing as what people think of when they hear the letters GMO, right? Mm-hmm. This is something different. But if it's possible to create a plant, let's say an almond tree or a potato plant, that requires far less space, far less money, far less water, far fewer resources, but produces more of the crop, suddenly that means that in densely urban areas, places like Delhi, where otherwise it might be hard to grow much needed vegetables and fruits, you suddenly would be able to do that. That solves a local problem. But if we take this out many more orders of magnitude, it also potentially causes disruption for grocery chains, Kroger in the United States or Marks and Spencer in the UK, you know, or any other number of places in Japan or, you know, wherever it might be. Because suddenly if we're able to locally grow the crops that we need with far fewer resources, then those giant grocery store chains may not need to exist. If you're not shipping all of that produce on such a regular basis, that disrupts the delivery and the logistics model of a company like UPS. I think one of the great takeaways here is that regardless of what industry you're in, you have to pay attention to what's happening across many modern sources of change. You really do have to look outside of your own industry because something like gene editing has a very real possibility of disrupting your business. Even though they may seem adjacently related or not at all related, but again, it's about how that technology or that science intersects with everyday life, and then we go forward. And as we go forward, things start to change.
Speaking of technology impact on people, there are several aspects of your trend report for 2017 that might be of concern to people, and that is the advancements being made in technology areas such as robotics, automation, and particularly artificial intelligence.
That's true. The things to bear in mind with AI is that it might feel very much like AI. Artificial intelligence is brand new, but the roots of AI go back hundreds of years, and we were building early systems of artificial intelligence in the 60s. So, you know, it's not that all of this is brand new. It just feels as though it's hit a sort of critical mass. Part of that is because we finally have the compute power to make a lot of these systems go. With that being said, when we talk about the future of AI, we tend to then follow that with AI robots are going to kill us all. And that represents a fundamental misunderstanding of where we are in the present and where we're going. Now, that's not to say that someday AI might take a whole bunch of jobs. or that AI could be combined with autonomous vehicles and robots that can make their own decisions, that could suddenly decide to kill us. There are those possibilities, but it's good to focus on what we know in the present so that we can plan more effectively. That would be things like natural language generation. There are some pretty cool things happening where the Voice of America, for example, might create a story. And depending on your level of English, you might select the beginner version, intermediate version, or advanced version of that story. The content would be exactly the same, but it would be automatically geared to your level of English ability. That is on the horizon, and that's certainly something that we're paying attention to. This AI will also allow us to do things like allow computers to do things like look at photos and look at videos and predict what is most likely going to happen next, and then to put some text around it, which is to say that in a few years, we could have news organizations looking for video and for photos, like online, that everyday people might post, and then stitching together news stories using that information. There's hundreds of different examples of areas to look at within AI that aren't simply robots are going to take our jobs or kill us all.
One thing I was thinking of as you were talking about applications of AI is something we've been talking about in this program, and that is the distribution of misinformation and fake news. Perhaps some form of AI can be developed that could be able to go in through the computer system, through the internet, and detect fake news and detect how it's being distributed and counteract that.
Yeah, I mean, Google has started to do that. If you go to Google News, you will be able to see tags where if the facts that are being represented in a story are taken out of context, you will see that labeled in some cases. But again, the challenge here is that ultimately facts, evidence, data are presented in some narrative form in order for us to be able to understand and make sense of whatever that story is. And the challenge is that every fact can be interpreted differently. So the real question, the nut that's difficult, I think, for an algorithm to crack easily is, what is fake, right? Especially when you're dealing with opinions or pieces that are not strictly explanatory journalism. That's hard. The only real way to sort of label content as true or believable would be to, in advance, figure out which sources are trustworthy and only present the content from those sources or to preference it in some way. That's one way to think about it, and it would definitely present some unique opportunities, and it would definitely be controversial in other ways.
So that the platform itself, like Facebook, would be the arbiter of what is allowed on the platform, and if it's deemed
right.
False information, they would flag it somehow, even on a personal feed?
Right. That's one way to do it. Now, they did introduce a tool a few weeks ago. Essentially, at this point, said, if you think it's fake, you got to tell us, and then we'll maybe do something about it. So if you spot news that appears to be fake, you could click on that V. It'll give you a drop-down. Then you have to go through several menu screens until you get to a point where you could click on a radial button that says, I think this is fake news. You know, but that's a lot of clicks. That's a lot of clicks. That's a lot of work.
It's a lot of effort, yes.
The average person to do. And it doesn't work as well on mobile. And how many, you know, the overwhelming majority of people are using their mobile devices to connect to social media.
Well, Amy, that reminds me of a saying a friend of mine told me. There are a lot of dumb people with smartphones. And I'm afraid we're going to have to end it on that rather dubious note. Amy Webb is founder and CEO of Future Today Institute. She's also the author of a new book, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Amy Webb, thank you so much again for talking with us, and we look forward to having you again next year.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Glenn Hollis. And joining me on the program was Rick Pantaleo, broadcaster and author of Science World Blog. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week and next year for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.